It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine is back with us for a look at some of the secrets of science, from Mars to human personalities. First, the federal regulations known as net neutrality are officially no more. Back in December, the Federal Communications Commission voted to scrap the Obama-era rules, which blocked broadband providers from slowing or blocking internet traffic selectively. That repeal went into effect today. Supporters of the repeal, including FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, say net neutrality stifled innovation. Those in favor of the protection say they were needed to keep the internet open and free. They also say that despite this repeal, the fight to restore net neutrality isn't over yet. Christopher Terry is an assistant professor of media ethics and law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. By the way, he got his PhD at UW-Madison, his master's at UW-Milwaukee. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Chris, depending on who you talk to, nothing at all changes today, no big deal, or this is a pivotal moment in the decline of the internet. Can you tell us what's at stake here?
Well, what's fundamentally different today as opposed to yesterday is who has control over internet content. Under the 2015 rules, consumers had the power to determine what content they wanted to access without interference from their ISP. Now the balance of power switches over to the ISPs, and they have the ability to determine what content you're allowed to access and at what speeds. And that's a fundamental change.
So these internet service providers, the argument from Ajit Pai and others who favor getting rid of net neutrality is they have no incentive to do this. They say they're not going to do this. They didn't do it before the net neutrality rules were in place. Do you find that reassuring?
I find it disingenuous entirely. We are at this point because of the exact fact that Comcast and the others have done blocking and throttling of content. The process that led to the 2015 rules began in 2004 with a GOP-led FCC passing rules that Comcast was found to have violated in 2008, which led to the first of three court cases over net neutrality. So the idea that they're not going to do this is entirely speculative, but history showed us that, A, that they have done it, and, B, Verizon has even argued that the only thing keeping them from doing it in a much more aggressive way was the fact that they were unsure where the rules would ultimately end up. So,
talk about blocking and throttling. How does that work on a practical level, and then what does that internet user at their phone or their computer see?
Well, blocking is just a straight, outright ban on your ability to access certain websites. It's most closely associated with what happened in the Comcast case back in 2008 and 2009, where Comcast internet subscribers were not allowed to go to peer-to-peer sites like torrent sites, for example. There just was an outright ban on accessing that type of application and website. Throttling is the idea that the speed at which content is delivered to you varies on depending on what content you're looking at. So where we saw throttling most actively was in the period between the Verizon decision, which happened in 2014, and the decision which led to today's order in 2015, where lots of companies had slowed Netflix down to the point to where it was essentially unusable by consumers.
During an appearance today on CBS this morning, Ajit Pai, the FCC head, was asked about the possibility of companies striking these kind of anti-competitive throttling deals, a hypothetical example being, say, AT&T striking a deal with Netflix and blocking out something like Hulu. Here's what Pai had to say about that.
We have empowered the Federal Trade Commission to take action against any company, including those in the situation that you mentioned, that might act in any competitive way. So consumers are going to be protected, and we preserve the incentive for companies to build out better, faster, cheaper internet access for consumers across the country.
So the Federal Trade Commission would step in and stop this kind of anti-competitive behavior, he's saying. Are you reassured?
That's an interesting argument. The Federal Trade Commission does not actually have the statutory authority to do what he describes in that clip there, although I'm unsure if he was being inarticulate in his attempt to get a soundbite in there or in his actual approach. The FTC can only do consumer protection. And what they're allowed to do in these terms are if your internet service provider is blocking or throttling you, they have to disclose that as part of their practices, but they're allowed to do it as long as they disclose. It's only at the point to where they're blocking you or throttling you, your ISP is blocking or throttling you, without disclosure that the Federal Trade Commission would have any authority, and that's a reach at that, to say to the ISP that they're in violation of net neutrality.
Talking to Christopher Terry, Assistant Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota, about the end of net neutrality. It ended, in effect, today. Chris, let's talk about the ongoing fight here. There's action in Congress. The Senate took action. They're looking. Democratic senators wrote a letter to Paul Ryan to say, hey, House, get on board there. What's going on in Congress now?
Congress is in the midst of passing what's known as a CRA, which is a check and balance that Congress has over administrative agencies. What the CRA does effectively is it essentially tells the FCC that Congress does not agree with its decision to repeal the 2015 Title II rules and that it should reinstate those rules. Now, that works through the quirks of administrative law that the FCC has to do what Congress tells it to do. Although it does have some independence, Congress can come back to an agency when it doesn't like the decision that's made and through a CRA order the agency to change its decision-making process. That's what the CRA is doing. The Senate passed that. It's sort of languishing in the House at this point.
Do you expect anything to happen in the House with this?
I would be skeptical, but I don't think it's entirely impossible. I think depending on how ISPs react to the passage of this today, you could see it become a pretty significant issue just before the election.
Do you think that Congress, whether this particular action goes through or not, do you think Congress needs to step in and do something to clarify this issue?
Yeah, and I've been very clear on that for a long time. I actually thought Congress should have stepped in right after the Comcast decision in 2009 and at least told the FCC what authority it was supposed to have. Part of the issue over Title II is that the Congress has not told the FCC how it wants the Internet handled in a formal way through a statutory delegation since 1996. And if you remember what the Internet was like in 1996, it looks fundamentally different than it does today. Congress shares part of the blame in this kerfuffle that we're having now in that they haven't given the FCC a clear set of guidelines one way or the other for that matter in more than 20 years.
We're in a big election year for Congress. If you look around online, some people are really up in arms about the end of net neutrality. But when it comes to voting, do enough voters to care about this to have this be an influence on how a member of, say, the House would vote?
I don't know the answer to that, I'll be honest. But I do think it is potentially the kind of political issue that can rally disparate groups together. Support for net neutrality is bipartisan among citizens, although not necessarily among legislators. And I think it's the kind of issue that, it, with proper mobilization, could be a significant political issue in the fall.
I want to dig into something you said earlier. These Internet service providers would have to disclose if they're doing some of these actions we talk about, slowing down some websites in favor of, say, their business partners elsewhere. Well, what would that disclosure look like? Is this, you know, in the terms of service that we all maybe glance at the subject headers at most?
Yeah, it would be addendums to the terms of service, most likely.
We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That's Christopher Terry, Assistant Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. He joins us to talk about the repeal of net neutrality, which went into effect today. Right now, it's time for our monthly check-in on some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science with Discover Magazine's Gemma Tarlak. Last week, NASA announced the Mars rover had found organic material on the red planet, which could have some interesting implications for life in our galaxy. And Gemma shares a bunch of fun science facts, the things we need to know about clouds, ants, and mass extinction. Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, good to be with you.
Let's start up on Mars, Gemma. What did the rover discover?
Well, unfortunately, we cannot answer David Bowie's question, tell me, is there life on Mars? But it did find two kind of cool new things. Now, other teams in the past have found suggestions of methane on the planet. So this new evidence of methane is not exactly earth-shattering, but the key thing about this new evidence that there's methane there is that the scientists journalists were able to document it over about a 55-month period, that it was seasonal in nature. Basically, there's a big spike in methane during the Northern Hemisphere summer on Mars. And that helps give them more information and also more confirmation that there is actually methane there. But, you know, a lot of things produce methane. Here on Earth, living things, perhaps most famously cows, produce methane. And then, of course, when we all shuffle off this mortal coil, the actual decomposition process produces methane. And there are also other non-biological methods. Certain volcanic eruptions, for example, produce methane. So just because they've found methane does not mean that there is something alive producing it. So I think it's important to have that caveat.
Now, methane is a little organic molecule, if I remember high school chemistry right. They also found some more complicated organic compounds, right?
Well, I think it's really important that the terminology here, because when I saw this story breaking, I saw a lot of people saying they found organic matter on Mars, and that's not quite right. What they found were organic molecules that appear to be pieces of larger and more complex molecules, the kind of thing you might find in coal or shale here on Earth. And again, the fact that they found them is very exciting, and it's an achievement for the scientists driving this research, but it's not the smoking gun, so right. to say, about life on Earth. So, again, there are a lot of different ways it could have ended up there, and it's kind of a couple more baby steps towards resolving if there is life on Mars or if there ever was life on Mars. So, exciting development.
As I read it, Gemma, it's necessary but not sufficient. To have life as we know it, you need this kind of stuff, but finding this stuff doesn't say anything about whether life is there.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, yeah.
All right, now I want to move on. You all had some fun at Discover Magazine. You picked a bunch of different topics and gave us kind of a need to know, the stuff we need to know about this. And Gemma, people tackled clouds and personality and music. You, let's start with yours. You went for mass extinction.
Of course, this tells us
something about Gemma, first of all. But what do we need to know about mass extinction, Gemma?
Well, I think there's a lot of interest in mass extinctions across the board. Not to be morbid, but just to imagine that there are forces out there that can just completely end life as we know it on the planet, and that this has already happened in the geological record at least five times. We've got these, in the last half billion years, we've got these five mass extinctions, these great die-offs. And you know, when you sit and think about it from like a philosophical perspective, it's kind of shocking and also kind of fascinating. How does this happen? What exactly happens? But I want to stress that just because it's called a great die-off, it's not all bad news. Because with every mass extinction, what we see is in the aftermath, you know, to quote Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park, life finds a way, nature finds a way. And what we see is after all these horrible things happen and so many species die, we see this incredible boom in biodiversity as the planet recovers. And a lot of times, you know, one door closes, another door opens. And we see, for example, the end of dinosaurs 65.5 million years ago. That is actually directly responsible for the rise of mammals, including us, because it kind of cleared all those ecological niches so that other animals could step in and develop and radiate into many different species. So not all bad news.
And the previous extinction to that one, you write, had opened the door for the creatures that became dinosaurs and the earliest mammals.
Yeah, exactly. You know, at the end Triassic, for example, the Triassic mass extinction of about 201 million years ago, it wiped clean a lot of the ecological niches, and dinosaurs, which had already begun to evolve, they hit their stride, and all of a sudden they were exploding in diversity, spreading across the Earth. So it was a great time to be a dinosaur.
And one worried, and on a serious note, concerns that there might be a sixth extinction and it might be in large part our fault.
Yes, yeah. And there is kind of, quite frankly, a terrifying amount of information out there. And in 2015, for example, researchers using a number of different ways to model and estimate the rate of extinction, they found that the current pace of extinctions of species on the planet is up to 100 times what's called the background rate. Now, the background rate is, you know, life is not forever, and there's always one species is going extinct, another species is emerging, and it's this background kind of static rate that exists throughout history and prehistory, geological time as well, of course. But this background rate spikes, and when you see those spikes, that's a sign of a mass extinction. And they found evidence that we are in the middle of one of those spikes. And it's actually what to me is the most sobering part is that a lot of researchers feel that by looking just at species becoming extinct globally, we're kind of missing the true horror of what one team of researchers called biological annihilation. And I realize that's a very scary term, and we should all be a little bit scared because, you know, it's not just like a species wakes up one morning and goes extinct globally. That does not happen. It's a slow downward spiral. First, it starts with the destruction and fragmentation of habitat, the introduction of invasive species. And then, you know, over time, localized extinctions called extirpations take place. And the species becomes weaker and weaker in terms of how far it's spread. And that leads to global extinction over time. And what we're seeing now is the number of local extinctions or extirpations is even higher than the actual global extinction rate. So that's very sobering. And, yeah, we're to blame. It's all on us.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. She's telling us some things we need to know about a variety of topics. Let's look up now, Gemma, at the clouds. We see them every day. I'll admit I take them for granted. What is a cloud? I mean, not in a poetic sense, like in a real science-y sense. What is it?
I think that I shall never see. Now, clouds, basically, they're just a bunch of water drops. They are teeny tiny water drops, whole piles of them, and we can't appreciate them with the naked eye just as a water drop. They're so small, but the atmosphere is full of these tiny water drops. And basically, as they rise, they cool off and they attract things. Things stick to them. Like, of course, pollution is one example, but also just, you know, dust, pollen, ice, sea salt, all kinds of stuff. Sand, for example, even. And so these vapors and the water droplets with stuff attached to them, just based on the temperature, the atmospheric height, what's stuck to them, all these different factors control how they're shaped and how they behave. And there are actually about 14 different species of clouds and 9 varieties. Really fascinating stuff, and they occur really at all levels of our atmosphere.
And I understand you have a couple of favorite kinds of clouds.
I do. I love, and this is going to sound terrible given that what I just said about mass extinctions, but I love the polar stratospheric clouds called nacreous clouds or mother of pearl clouds, even though they're like actually a really bad sign of the ozone layer being destroyed. But they're beautiful. They look kind of, they only occur. They're very high altitude, 70,000 feet or higher, I believe, and they only occur at 60 degrees latitude or above. So basically, you know, the polar circles. But when you see them, it's like someone took iridescent finger paint and just smeared it across the sky. It doesn't look real. It looks like something from Star Wars or some other sci-fi movie.
And that was one of your favorites. What's another, maybe a happier one?
I'm such a downer. Sorry to everybody. But lenticular clouds, they are also very, very cool. And I'm sure you've all seen the photos of a single large mountain like Mount Hood or Mount Everest with this what looks like a stack of perfectly round flying saucers on top of it. Those are lenticular clouds. And they actually form when the air coming over the mountains kind of gets trapped, and they just stack up there, and they look seriously like a stack of plates, and they're just really neat, and apparently they are what's behind a lot of flying saucer UFO sightings.
Interesting. Okay, that's a cool one. Wow, we've got a few more and not much time to get to them. Let's look at personality. What amazed me about reading about what we understand about human personality is how little we for sure understand about human personality and what it is.
Yeah, and that's really, it's so hard to figure out what it is and also how to measure it. You know, there have been a lot of scientists in the 20th century who approached it as like, well, I'm going to develop a way to test and categorize personality. But it's really hard to do. And so, for example, right now, I think a group of tests called the Big Five or the Ocean Tests are very popular, and they test, as you might imagine from the name, five traits. But that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of other ways of testing, everything from projective tests like the Rorschach ink blots to these very involved tests where you describe different people in your life and their relationships to each other. And by describing other people who are in your life, the person analyzing you is able to tell a great deal about you and your personality. So I think it's there's still work to be done in this field, but it's really fascinating how many different directions it's taken off in terms of theories about how to figure out who we are.
And let's check in on who ants are very briefly, Jemma. A piece about ants. This is the one. I'm going to key in on one fact here. There is a colony of ants that spreads like around a huge chunk of the Mediterranean, international, multi-country, and it's all these sub-ant colonies that seem to be part of one big super colony.
Yeah, there are these a couple species of ants. They're originally from Argentina, but they've spread all around the world, and they do form super colonies. And the largest one that's known is 2,500 miles long. And it starts, if you imagine a map of Europe, it starts in northwestern Spain and follows the Atlantic coast and then the Mediterranean all the way to northern Italy. And it's one super colony. It's got millions of queens, billions of workers. It's considered a super colony because if an ant, say, from northern Portugal, the super colony corner of northern Portugal, ran into one from Italy, they would actually not fight. And they would get along and, you know, be kind of kumbaya about it, if ants can ever be kumbaya. So it's kind of fascinating.
Well, I, for one, want to be the first to welcome our new ant overlords. Jemma, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Jemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to share some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. We saw in an article the other day that one of the favorite ways to put off something that you should do but you don't really want to is baking. Apparently, whipping up some cookie dough or getting a cake into the oven is popular with everyone from college students to CEOs. There's even a name for it, apparently, procrastibaking. Baking is just one way to procrastinate. You probably have some variations of your own, but why do we do it? And is it necessarily bad to put things off? We asked Regan Gurung to tackle the issue. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joins us now from our Green Bay studios. Regan, good to have you back.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, before we get into the why, do you procrastinate yourself, Regan?
Absolutely. I think humans in general procrastinate sometimes or the other, and I think the question is when and can you shut it off?
And I do too, and it's very good. I intentionally went into a line of work where I have a very solid deadline that gives me no choice but to get things done. But why is it that we do it, Regan? We know that thing. Getting the taxes done, writing that letter, getting the job done, cleaning up, whatever, has to happen. Why don't we just do it?
I think at the most basic level, we tend to procrastinate over things that we don't really want to do or are stressful. And just the thought of doing it makes us nervous or anxious, and especially anxious. And sometimes if something is boring, you just don't want to do it. And so it's much easier to distract ourselves and do something else. You know, oh, I think I need to clean my closet again or rearrange the books. That's one of my favorites is I think I want to rearrange the books I have instead of actually getting on with the task. And I think that's one of the most basic reasons that we tend to procrastinate is it's avoiding something that's we just don't want to do.
And there's that technique there. Ah, there's this other thing that I can do, and I'm still being productive and accomplishy. I'm just not doing the thing I should be doing. So that whether we're talking about procrastinating or rearranging those books, we have a method to our procrastination madness.
You know, absolutely. And I think you mentioned how you can choose a job where it makes procrastination harder. I think there's also a really interesting personality difference here. I think some of us tend to be more conscientious than others. Some of us tend to be more comfortable with procrastinating and are much more comfortable with, you know, coming up to a deadline. And we actually savor that little, ooh, I love the stress of, you know, grace under pressure, as it were.
Talking to Regan Gurung from UW Green Bay about procrastination. Regan, you wrote about this on your blog, and you say procrastination can actually be a good thing if we do it right. Can you talk us through the wrong ways and the right ways?
Absolutely. I think the big distinction that I'd like to make is, or when I think about this, is there's procrastination before you actually start doing something, and procrastination in between a task. And especially the article that you alluded to on procrastinate baking, more often than not, the examples in that article were individuals who started on a task and then took a break from the task to bake, or and then went back to the task. That's very, very different. It's very different if you don't start compared to actually starting, maybe hitting a wall or being tired off it and taking a break to do something and then coming back. So I call the latter productive procrastinating, where it's still procrastination. I mean, which by definition is delaying of a task. I mean, you are delaying getting the task done, but there are definitely times when that delay can be more helpful than not.
Yeah, what do we get while we're doing that other thing? If we've already started, it's a delay, it's not postponing the whole project, we have it in our brains, then what can happen that's going to help us?
So there are a couple of different things going on. You know, one of the big elements of how we as human beings behave and work and function is that there's a lot of stuff going on in our heads underneath our conscious awareness. And when we start a task, even if we then switch, procrastinate, and go do something different, at a non-conscious level, we are still probably working on that task. So much so that when you come back to that something that you put off, but you started, you may actually find that you're further along than you were when you left it because your brain has been non-consciously working on it. So there's definite evidence of this non-conscious processing when you step away from something on one hand. On the other hand, there's also a form of consolidation. For example, we now know that if you have a choice of either staying up late and studying for something and then going to bed, or waking up early and then studying for something, it's much better to stay up late and finish studying. Why? Because when we sleep, our brains consolidate the information. There's actually strengthening of those neuronal pathways. And so whatever you've studied or read just before you go to sleep actually gets consolidated in memory while we sleep. And I think there's something like that happening when we take a break from a task once we've started it.
It seems like there's a trend, Regan, in guests I've talked to, including you, and books I've read. We used to think, okay, how can I get this single-minded focus on what I'm doing, whether that's studying or writing the business plan or whatever task it is. That we used to think was the gold standard, and now, at least in pop culture, and now it seems like, no, the value is, how do we creatively disrupt, interrupt that a little bit, step away so we come back with that flash of insight and refreshed afterward?
Yeah, and I think it's not so much the disrupt, but it's actually help out our brains, because I think we human beings can only be focused on something for a certain amount of time. Now, I think that amount of time is actually longer than we assume, and when you see people quickly checking email or Facebook or Twitter, that's not just because we have short attention spans. I think that's something we can work on. But especially when you're working on a focused task for work or for school or at home, there's only so far we can go before we need a break. And I think it's not so much disrupting it, but actually giving our brains the break away from it that can help it.
That reminds me, something you wrote, you say there are good ways to procrastinate. So when we've already started that project, baking could be one of them. One bad way is to just surf around on the internet. Why is that a bad way to procrastinate?
I think one of the biggest reasons that surfing on the net is a bad way is, firstly, it's almost like going down the rabbit hole where it is very easy to lose track of what's going on and time. But I think more importantly, if you're surfing, you're actually probably using more of those mental resources and not really giving your brain that time to reflect on the task that you've been doing. So, for example, I like the example of Darwin or Thoreau, who spent time going on walks. Apparently, the story goes that Darwin worked about 4 hours a day of intense work, but then went for a walk. No, did he take notes? Was he jotting things down? Maybe he was. But for the most part, he gave his brain some time to reflect and sort things through. And I think that's one of the big things that in our modern society with all our devices, we don't get enough of. That time of, in quotes, nothing, where our brain can sift and winnow through all the things that it's doing and needs to do. And when you're surfing on the internet, well, there's no sifting winnowing time because, you know, you're falling for clickbait.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Anne is with us in Green Bay. Anne, hi.
Hello. Well, I've turned 62 recently. I'm planning on retiring at the end of the year. Realize my life is getting shorter, so I don't call it procrastinating anymore. I call it retirement training.
So do you have a method to your procrastination / retirement training, Anne?
Yep, fun comes before cleaning, though.
Fun comes before cleaning. I love it. Well, and then, Regan, that's a value judgment there, too. Yes, sometimes there's the stuff we've got to do, but sometimes the cleaning could wait another day, and we could do something more fulfilling in the meantime.
Well, I think Anne nicely puts her finger on a really key word, which is prioritization. You know, and sometimes I think at different points of our lives, we prioritize things differently. And there are some things that are filed under the work category that may not need to be done right then. And it may be okay to put them off for later. And I love the way Anne said, you know, fun comes before cleaning. Absolutely. And I think in the big scheme of things, we've got to balance the big picture of what's due when and how much intrinsic value it has to us.
We're talking to Regan Goering about procrastination and when it can be actually an okay strategy, if we do it right. He's a professor of human development and psychology at UW Green Bay, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you describe yourself as a procrastinator? Are there particular tasks in your life that you just keep putting off and putting off? What is your favorite diversion from what you know you should be doing? Do you think it actually is helpful sometimes, as Regan was saying, to take that break in the middle of the thing you've been focusing on? Do something completely different. Come back to it, maybe with a fresh eye. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We pick up our conversation about procrastination with Regan Goering from UW Green Bay, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself procrastinating, or did you used to, but you found a way to rein that in? Are you in a relationship where you have one procrastinator, one not? How do you work that out? Call in at 800-642-1234. And do you think that procrastination can be a good thing? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. Mitch is on the line in Chilton. Mitch, hi.
Hey there.
What do you want to tell us about, Mitch?
Well, I had a question about procrastination. There's some things I've been putting off for years in my life, and I always tell myself, well, I'll really get to it. But it's been years, like finishing a play or a script or maybe making a call to a relative that I haven't made in a while. I guess that's procrastination. I'm wondering if you have any tips for how to deal with those things that they seem to grow in their monstrosity the longer I put them off.
Mitch, thanks a lot for that call. And at first, I was like, years, really? And then I think, yeah, there's, you know, old friends that I think, oh, I should call or write someday, and I don't do it today, and I don't do it next week. I'm probably in the same boat. And Regan, it sounds like these are things Mitch wants to do. He wants to finish that play. He wants to talk to that relative. Why do we procrastinate in that way?
Well, I think this goes back to us avoiding or delaying things that we fear may not be easy to do. I mean, especially writing a play, that sounds like quite the challenge, right? And I think this is a great case of, in terms of what's a good way or something new to try, this is where I like to think about this suggestion. Actually, it's a 100-year-old plus suggestion, but it was recently brought back up. William James, the father of American psychology, basically said, if we want to try to do something that we've been avoiding doing, we should do it for a short period of time and pretend as if we like doing it. And I think those two words, do it or as if, is the key. More recent research has shown that if you've been putting something off, tell yourself, I'm going to do it for just 10 or 15 minutes, but I'm going to do it as if I really enjoy it. And lo and behold, what research shows is that if you go into doing it with that attitude, the pretending almost that you like it, it frees you up to actually like it. And more often than not, you find yourself continuing with that activity.
So in Mitch's case, he could say, hey, I'm going to get this opening to act two. Maybe it's not going to be perfect, but I'm going to have fun putting it together.
Absolutely. Give it a shot as if it's a lot of fun, and you may actually find that it is.
Mitch, good luck. Look forward to the big opening when it hits Broadway. Back to your calls. Ryan is with us in Menominee. Ryan, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
So me being a college student, I figure procrastination is one of the best ways to help get you through long periods of studying, because sitting down and just grinding for hours and hours at a time just seems super inefficient. So you kind of just go for it a little bit, and then you can, like, just procrastinate, and it just helps you keep your mind so much more sharper.
And, Ryan, what do you do in those breaks, I guess, to step away from the grind?
I hang out with friends. I go to the movies. I play some video games. It's just anything that can get me away from what I'm doing. Just go have some fun. Give your mind a break.
Now, this isn't the night right before the exam where you're doing all that stuff, right? You're spacing that out.
Oh, yeah, I'm totally spacing it out.
All right. Ryan, thanks a lot for the call. And, yeah, Regan, I think we've probably all been there, especially if we've been studying. You hit that point of diminishing returns where
right.
you can stare at that book for another 5 hours. You're not going to get anything more out of it.
Well, I think, and Ryan, I'm guessing from what he said that he takes a break, but then he goes back
right.
to doing what he was
That's
doing.
That's the key, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Ryan, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Can we schedule this kind of thing, Regan, when we're in that grind where we can say, okay, I'm going to set an alarm on my phone to tell me to step away and do something fun and different?
Absolutely. That's one of the suggested pragmatic ways to deal with you helping you even get started. So let's say you're procrastinating getting started on something. Start it as if you're going to like it, and then tell yourself, I'm only going to do this for X amount of time, and I will stop and give myself a treat or do something different at that time. So you're not shackled to doing it. You've already got that milestone that you can look forward to. And what's interesting is when studies have tried to vary how much that time is, there are many cases when the time is reached and the person goes, you know, I'm actually really enjoying this. I don't want to stop now, you know, and that's great. So I think building yourself that reinforcement or, you know, rewarding yourself for some good work is definitely an incentive that can keep you going and ensure that you're less likely to procrastinate on getting actually started in the first place.
Ryan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Regan Gurung, psychology professor at UW Green Bay, about procrastination. How to and how to do it effectively and ineffectively, for that matter. Back to your calls. Dave is with us in La Crosse. Dave, hi.
Hi. I just want to partly disagree with the lady that said cleaning can wait because it depends on what kind of cleaning. Floors and windows and that sort of thing can wait. But I've got a 30-year accumulation of papers and financial accounts and stuff that I haven't, you know, I've cleaned, I worked on them a little bit, but now I've got boxes and boxes of stuff that I don't even recognize anymore. And I spent like a year getting rid of half of them just because they don't make any sense anymore. And I've got to call banks and figure out what all this stuff was and whether it still exists. So try to get some of it, the trash out of the way if you can before you forget what it is.
Dave, thanks a lot. Yeah, sort of that, I guess it's a triage process, Regan, trying to figure out what we can put off and what we can't.
Well, and I think beyond that, it's also the notion of don't look at the entire task as a whole. Break it down into smaller pieces. So maybe Dave can look at one box instead of the five boxes and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to start on this one box. And just the sense of accomplishment that Dave would get from that one box would probably go a long way and make it more likely that he'll come back to boxes 3 to 5 or 3 to 10 later.
Dave, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, I've done that sort of thing with, I could go down and say, okay, I'm going to clean the basement, and that's such a monumental task. Where do you start? I'm going to clean out this corner of the basement. That's something I might actually get done, and as you say, start to build that momentum.
Absolutely.
I will say my basement is still not clean, though. So, Regan, what about, I mean, there's some people out there who know, hey, I have a problem with procrastination. It actually interferes with my life. I put things off too long, and it bites me later on. What can they do?
Well, I think when you say, I think the recognizing the problem and don't wait until you get, you know, called into your boss or a failing grade to recognize the problem. I think if you see this consistent pattern, I think start small. Start small, you know, earlier on, I think it was Mitch who mentioned a whole list of things that he'd like to do. Have a clear list someplace. I mean, something I do is if there's a bunch of things that I know I should get moving on, I literally on my calendar have a bunch of little post-its of things that I may not have time or want to do right now, but I know I should do. And I look up at every now and then I look up at that calendar and pull down one of those little post-its and tackle it. It's one little thing, but it's not out of sight, so it doesn't get lost. So I think really the key solution here is divide things up into smaller, more manageable packets and reward yourself for getting those things done. But starting small, once you start on these things, it'll be reinforcing in itself and it'll help you do more of these things down the line.
My problem sometimes with the to-do list is, you know, big thing that I really want to put off, little thing that's easy, and five more of those. And I knock off those fun, easy things, and still that big thing's still staring at me.
You know, that's why you need different colored post-its where you can only tackle one color at a time.
This is a green day. This is a red
day.
There
you, exactly.
One more caller I think we have time for. Bill is with us in Westfield. Bill, hi.
Hello there.
Hey, Bill.
What do you want to tell us about, Bill?
Well, I want to talk to you about procrastination. It's been a big problem with me. I've bought trailers and haven't registered in my name. I've just used them until I wanted to sell them, and what a time I had trying to get them together.
Oh.
But anyway, the main thing I wanted to say was I read a book, and I hope I can say it over the air. It's a book. The name of it was Make Your Bed. It's a very small book. It was written by a retired Navy SEAL.
An admiral.
Retired Navy SEAL.
Bill, I'm going to jump in. Regan, you're familiar with this?
Yes. This was an admiral who, at a commencement speech, I think he shared the five things that he had learned from 25 years in the Navy. And one of those things was the first thing in the morning, make your bed and the day will go better. Bill, is that the book?
Yes, but what he said was the first project you do, if you do it first and you do it right and you know you did it right, you look back and you did a good job, every other thing you do during the day will work out for you.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. And just in our last minute or so, Regan, whether it's making the bed or that other small thing, it seems like making that small step to get at what Bill was talking about, that great feeling, that's going to keep you going.
Better planning is at the heart of everything. Plan better. It takes things off of your mind, makes you easier to tackle things.
And Regan, do you have another bookshelf for your organization in the works?
I've already done that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. Regan, always good to talk to you.
Great. Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Regan Gruing, professor of human development and psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joined us from our studio in Green Bay to talk about procrastination and how we can use it to our advantage. You can find his blog post on the subject at the Ideas Network Facebook page or over at WPR.org. And if you were meaning to call that whole time and, well, you just kept putting it off and finding something else to do instead, not to worry. You can still share your thoughts on procrastination, how it's affected your life, maybe how you've gotten over it, how you break up that study session or work session, whatever it is you do. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us your procrastination story. Do it now or, you know, later or tomorrow or next week, whatever. It all works. We'll watch for it on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You may have seen this online. For a week or so now, the restaurant chain IHOP, as in International House of Pancakes, has been teasing a name change. Instead of IHOP, they were promoting the name IHOB with a B instead of a P. They promised to reveal the meaning of the B today. Well, now it's today, and the B, it turns out, was for burger, because they sell burgers, and it's not a permanent name change. They just wanted to highlight the non-pancake part of their menu. anticlimactic. Yes, I don't have strong feelings about the temporary name change or the restaurant chain. Some people love it, some not. But IHOP did play a key role in my life. I'll tell you how. One time, I think I'm 9 or 10, and I think it was my grandparents took me for the first time to an IHOP. We didn't have one in my hometown. And on the menu were chocolate chip pancakes. And it was kind of an eye-opener, like, you can do that? And I ordered it, and they let me get away with it, and I had chocolate chip pancakes. And so fast forward some years when I started making pancakes, I made my own chocolate chip pancakes and then did weird stuff, and it ultimately culminated in my famous banana coffee chocolate chip pancakes, wait, a la mode. Yeah, some vanilla ice cream and the maple syrup. I haven't made those in a long time, but hey, maybe it's time to bring it back. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.